Hello, this is Beth Logan with Family Caregiver Alliance. We'd like to welcome you to the telecaregiving workshop, Therapeutic Work with Ambiguous Loss, presented by Dr. Pauline Boss. It's our hope that everyone has successfully downloaded Dr. Boss's presentation or has it on view on their computer screen. We have just a few questions before we begin. If you're having sound problems or problems with your telephone connection, simply press star zero, and an operator will assist you. This is an operator-assisted call. During the presentation, your lines will be on mute, so no one will be able to hear what's going on at your CRC. Dr. Boss will take questions from you three times during the presentation. When it's time for question and answers, the operator will announce that we're opening up the phone lines for questions. If you have a question, please just press the number one key on your telephone and you'll be placed in queue. Your name or the group leader's name will be announced by the operator as along with the name of your CRC. Then you know it's your turn to speak. Please keep your questions short and succinct. If you do not have the opportunity to ask your question, you may email the question to me at the end of the presentation, and I will pass them on to Dr. Boss. All questions and answers will be shared with all of the CRC staff. My email address is bethlogan@comcast.net. You can also find my email address in today's instructions that you've downloaded. I am now very pleased to introduce you to Dr. Pauline Boss. Dr. Boss is Professor Emeritus at the University of Minnesota and member of the American Psychological Association, American Association of Marriage and Family Therapy, and National Council on Family Relations. She is also a therapist in private practice. Widely recognized for groundbreaking research on ambiguous loss, Dr. Boss is known as a pioneer in the interdisciplinary study of stress. Since 1973, she has researched family stress, especially where there is unclear loss. She summarized her work in a widely acclaimed book, Ambiguous Loss, Learning to Live with Unresolved Grief. Dr. Boss's most recent book, Loss, Trauma, and Resilience, presents therapeutic treatment guidelines and is based on her work with families of the physically missing after 9/11 and in Kosovo, with the International Committee of the Red Cross, as well as her work with families of loved ones missing psychologically from Alzheimer's disease, chronic mental illness, and traumatic brain injury. For more information, please visit her website at www.ambiguousloss.com. I'd now like to turn the presentation over to Dr. Boss.
Hello, everyone. I'm sitting here in an early Minnesota spring where the snow is still melting and thinking of all of you in sunny California with envy. So let's begin. We have a lot of material to cover. And as I had said before, or had message sent to you, I hope it is necessary for you to read the book and study the book because we can't cover and do justice to the material in an hour and a half. What I hope to do, though, is give you a sketch of the ideas to whet your appetite to read further and to use this material in your work as social workers. The brief history, now we're on slide number two, the brief history of ambiguous loss theory development takes place already back in the 70s after the Vietnam War, and in fact it was in California at the Center for Prison of War Studies in San Diego where I began the work with families of soldiers missing in action. Since then, I've worked with families of caregivers of Alzheimer's disease, family caregivers of Alzheimer's disease, and then more recently, again, back to physical absence after 9/11, and now currently, again, with the military, back to psychological absence regarding traumatic brain injury in the soldiers and Marines coming back from Iraq with traumatic brain injury. In all cases, my focus is on the family, not on the patient per se. So I work in collaboration with the doctors who take care of the patient. My job, as I suspect your job, is to lower the stress for the families who must take care of these people and live with perhaps an illness that won't go away, such as Alzheimer's disease or traumatic brain injury. I believe that absence and presence of loved ones is not an absolute. Even without death, the people we care about disappear physically or psychologically. This is not an unusual phenomenon. Rather, I think ambiguous loss is very common. It just hasn't been talked about before, and it's a new concept now in psychology, which I introduced in the 70s. But in fact, if you read literature and poetry, the artists have long ago found out about it and do a great deal of writing about it. The assumptions are, number one, there is a psychological family. There's an entire chapter about that in the book. But let me talk a bit about it. I define the family very loosely. And when I was a visiting professor at Hunter in New York City 2 years ago, they got nervous when I would talk about my actual love of family, my valuing of family, in that they often saw family as the enemy to young people, adolescents, and so on. But let me talk about how I see family. First of all, I define it very, very broadly. I think family is who you think it is, who is there for you in times of joy and in times of sadness and need, who is there for you on the holidays and the celebrations that are important to you, who do you want there, who don't you want there? And so, of course, in step families, remarried families, life gets more complicated. And so now I always ask people I work with, who do you see as your family? That is called the psychological family. The other definition of family, of course, more sociological, is based on the census data. Who lives in the household, or who has a marriage certificate, who are the biological children of a couple, et cetera, or of a single parent. I'm less interested in the latter than I am in the former regarding the kind of work that I do. But you may need to ask both. Certainly funding has to do with the latter, but I think the kind of work we do, how to give care to somebody who might not get better, really has to do with the psychological family. The second assumption is a stress and resiliency focus that balances the existing medical pathology focus. And there we go to figure 1.2 on page 12 in the text, but in fact, it's on the next slide, slide 3. So you can move over to slide 3. And the stress and resiliency focus, in fact, takes the blaming and the shaming off of the families. They may feel helpless, as if they don't quite have a handle on things. And really, it's not because of their psychic weakness. It's because of a strange situation that they are found in. The context is sick. They aren't. It's the context of having somebody who's partially there and partially gone. And that situation is maddening to people because they have difficulty making sense of it. And so what you have in figure 1.2 is what we call the ABCX model. A is the event or situation, and in this case it's a situation because it's not like breaking a leg, which is an event, goes on and on forever, an ambiguous loss situation. And then it's related to the resources that people bring to cope with it. For example, intelligence, education, a job, income, more people on the team versus one perhaps single parent who has to cope with it all. And then also up above perceptions, boundary ambiguity is one example of how people see this event of ambiguous loss. They may not be sure if the person is in their family or not, and that I call boundary ambiguity. And the more unclear they are about who is in or who is out of the family regarding boundaries and roles, the more stress they will experience and trauma. Sometimes it doesn't reach the level of trauma, and that, of course, would be good. We'll talk more about why that might be later. But what we're after is a low degree of stress, living, caregiving for this chronic ambiguous loss, and I would call that managing the stress and more resiliency. And I write a great deal about resiliency. In this situation, my definition of resiliency, I narrow it down to this. It's the ability to live comfortably with ambiguity. It's the ability to live comfortably with a person who is partly here and partly gone. That's not easy. We'll talk more about that. Slide number 4, what is ambiguous loss? It's a loss that is unclear and thus has no closure. We'll talk a lot about no closure. There can be no closure with ambiguous loss. And I know we're all trained to look for it, so this is an exception. Next, a situation or problem that has no answer and thus no resolution. The difference between ambiguous loss and ordinary loss from death is that with a clear-cut death, you have a death certificate, you have a coroner who comes in and pronounces someone dead. You may have a funeral or some kind of ritual or mourning, sitting Shiva or wake, where the community is brought in to verify that someone has died. And most often you have a body or ashes to bury or dispense with. So it's clear that the person has transformed into another state and that life will be different. With ambiguous loss, you have none of these. So you're left with an uncertainty and a lack of clarity about whether the person will come back or not. And in fact, it's very common for loved ones to believe, let's say with brain injury or with Alzheimer's disease, well, they were themselves today, and maybe they don't have this disease. And when that happens, I just validate the people because they need that glimmer of hope, even though the next day they may clearly know that's not true. The difference between ambiguous loss and trauma and PTSD and complicated grief is very important, and I encourage you to read the text, page 1 to 22 on that. But let me say this now. Trauma is the inherent core in PTSD and in ambiguous loss. But in ambiguous loss, it's a relational stressor. That is, it's a stressor because there's somebody whom you love or care about that is partly here and partly gone. So ambiguous loss, unlike PTSD, is not a psychological pathology, and it is not an individual problem. It's a relational problem, and therefore relational interventions are needed. I might add a footnote here that the new research on PTSD is that PTSD requires a relational intervention now too. Let's move to slide number 5. Why does it matter? Due to the ambiguity surrounding the loss, individuals, couples, and families remain confused. Without comprehension, they can't make sense of the situation to cope. Without meaning, they can't find hope to help them move forward with their lives. They're simply stuck. You will remember words from your college education here. There is no sense of coherence, as Antonovsky said. There is no agency. There is no mastery to make decisions. You're simply stuck. So there's no closure, no agency, no sense of coherence. And as a result, people feel depressed because of this stuckness. They feel helpless. And as you know, helplessness is the strong predictor of depression. Ambiguous loss, then, is not the same as depression, but it is clearly, for many people, a predictor of depression. Slide number 6. Two types of ambiguous loss. The first type is physical absence with psychological presence. And that would be like people who are physically missing. They've disappeared, kidnapped, separated, or in a more normal example these days would be military deployment, where you have a father or a mother in a family or a husband or a wife, but they are temporarily deployed. So at the moment, they are physically absent. That is always the stressor for a family. But the first ones, missing, disappeared, kidnapped, are always more severe because there is absolutely no contact and no information as to where the loved one is. Type 2 is where people are physically present. You can see them and touch them, but they are psychologically absent. And this may be what you work with the most. And that would be with addictions, dementia, chronic mental illness such as autism, depression, bipolar, schizophrenia, and we should add their traumatic brain injury. Turn to the next slide, 7. This is half of the model that is on page 9 in the textbook, and I encourage you to study that. On the left side of the model, I want to read some of those examples. There is a catastrophic and unexpected examples of war, missing soldiers, natural disasters, missing persons, incarceration, desertion, mysterious disappearance, and missing bodies from murder and plane crashes, etc. But there are more common situations of that type also, which, and this affects your work especially, immigration, migration, adoption, divorce, remarriage, work location, military deployment, which I mentioned, young adults about to leave home, and elderly mates moving into a nursing home. Those are all more common examples of loved ones who become physically missing. On the right side of that model, situations of physical presence, the catastrophic examples would be Alzheimer's disease and other dementias, chronic mental illness, addictions, including alcohol, drug, and gambling, depression. A person who's depressed is there in body but not in mind, and traumatic head injury and brain injury, and people in a coma. The more common examples of that kind of ambiguous loss are homesickness from immigration or migration, and adoption, where somebody is pining for a parent that they never met, for example, divorce, remarriage, someone is pining for the non-custodial parent, preoccupation with work and obsession with computer games, internet, and TV. Now, what's important for you, and this is on slide 8 now, is that they will often overlap. Type 1 and type 2 may overlap in the same person, couple, or family, and either type can be catastrophic or more common. So you may have in the same person a depression because someone is missing, their mate is missing physically, but their mother has Alzheimer's disease, so they have another loved one missing psychologically. We find this a great deal. After 9/11, children would say they lost both of their parents, that daddy was in the World Trade Center site, had disappeared into the dust of that, but mama was also gone because she was so depressed they could no longer get to her. Okay, questions about this first part.
Ladies and gentlemen, again, if you'd like to ask a question, press the 1 key on your touchtone phone.
Colleen, it looks like we don't have questions at this time.
Okay, so good. We'll keep going then.
Sounds great.
Okay. Because this next section is longer, we may, in fact, even need the extra time. But write down your questions as you have them. I'll be happy to we'll give you a chance each time we hit a certain end of a section here. All right. We'll now go to slide 9 then, effects of ambiguous loss. The effects are numerous, but they're devastating to people. And by the way, I need to say up front that it doesn't always have a negative effect on all people. Some people are more resilient than others regarding the tolerance for ambiguity. I have found in this state of Minnesota that the Native Americans are better than the Euro-Americans on tolerating ambiguity, in this case, caregiving for Alzheimer's disease. They are able to flow with the tide, if you will, more, or as they say to me, you know, we came in the world as a child and we may go out as a child, and it's just the circle of life. By the way, Shakespeare said that too in another way. Whereas Euro-Americans or our mainstream culture more often is trying to cure and to fix and sees, for example, dementia as a failure to cure. Now, I need to tell you that I'm somewhere in the middle. I really do want to find a cure for illnesses, for Alzheimer's disease and so on. So I'm not totally on one side or the other, nor are the Native Americans, by the way. They balance a mastery, an idea of fixing things with an idea of accepting the things that can't be fixed. By the way, does that have an echo for you regarding the Serenity Prayer? If it does, you're right on. That's one of the best stress management set of words I've ever known, the Serenity Prayer, and it does fit what I'm saying here. So the effects of ambiguous loss, number one, it immobilizes individuals and thus their relationships. Things freeze. And so you can call it complicated grief in the DSM. You can call it pathological mourning. You can call it frozen grief, as I have. Whatever it is, it's immobilization, and that is never good for a human being, to be stuck, to be helpless. Number two, which is more cognitive, it confuses the decision-making processes. Number three, it freezes the grief process. You can't go through, you can't even begin the grief process because you don't know if the person is dead or alive. And in fact, they're alive. And so it would make you feel mighty guilty if you started to grieve, as many caregivers of Alzheimer's parents and spouses do. And I think it's our job to normalize that. It blocks the coping processes. It prevents closure. Before we're done today, you will see that I'm not fond of the word closure anymore. I think it's a problem word. And it should not be our goal. Rather, our goal should be to live with the loss, to live with the ambiguity, rather than to say, okay, I've shut the door on this now, I can forget about it and move forward. We never forget about even a clear-cut death of a loved one. For example, a favorite grandparent, you think of them at holiday times, and you may wear their jewelry or have something of theirs that you treasure. And that's a good thing. So we never have 100% closure. Number six, the effects of ambiguous loss lead to feelings of helplessness, hopelessness, exhaustion, and therefore depression. Slide number 10, the relational outcomes of ambiguous loss. Here is where you need to be more focused on the group, not just the individual caregiver. Caregivers usually live in a family of some sort, and you want to ask them who their family is, their biological family, their legal family, but also their psychological family, because they're going to need support. An outcome of ambiguous loss is almost always conflict, couple-family conflict. It is eerie how often conflict follows ambiguous loss. In New York after 9/11, it was even on a community scale when the police and the firemen actually had a fistfight and landed in jail. And it, in fact, was many of the wives of the missing men who said to the mayor, "Let them out, they're hurting too." Separation, divorce, and cutoffs are frequently outcomes of ambiguous loss. Again, the confusion sets everybody off, and there's a lot of conflict. Now, the third one is interesting, and it's an opening for you as social workers to help these caregivers, caregiving families. They tend to stop family rituals and celebrations. And here is where we intervene first off, because it's an easy place to intervene. It's a place, family rituals and celebrations remind people of happy times in the past. It's familiar in the midst of ambiguity. And so it's a good place to say, what are you going to do for the next holiday? Let's talk about how you can organize it, even though this person is not fully present. The last two show that one of the other outcomes of ambiguous loss is that people start mistrusting professionals and getting angry at them. I think this can be avoided. We tend traditionally to call that resistance, but I think it's our resistance, not the family caregiver's resistance. If we come in and say, you are depressed, we need to treat you for depression, the caregiver is going to think that she or he is weak or sick and we are going to treat them. What you need to say to them is that they're not sick, the situation is sick. The context is a problem, not them. But their depression is an outcome of the stress of ambiguity. I put it in a stress model as opposed to a pathology medical model because, first of all, I believe that's what it is, but also people accept it much more readily. It's not a shame to be distressed from having to caregive 7 days a week, 24 hours a day, but there is for a lot of people and a lot of people, immigrant people who are not accustomed to the European-American therapy idea, who feel there is shame in being referred to a social worker or a therapist. So just reframe that for them. You're fine. Anybody would be depressed doing what you're doing. By the way, I believe that. I don't know if you've ever tried being grounded to a caregiving job 7 days a week, 24 hours a day. I think it would depress the best of us. There's also anxiety, of course, and anxiety is a normal outcome of ambiguity. You don't know what the diagnosis is for sure. You don't know what's going to happen here. You don't know if you have enough finances to cover what you need. So there is a great deal of ambiguity, all of which will cause anxiety. The first two I see, by the way, as quite normal and things that you and I should help people deal with, but not to tell them that it is the result of their weakness. It is a result of the situation they are finding themselves in. The last three, of course, are pathological and need treatment. And it's our job to triage and say, here is something that does need treating, and that would be substance abuse, violence, and suicide. So the first two I would normalize, the last three I would not, and I would refer them to medical treatment, to professional treatment immediately for that. By the way, you still treat the depression and the anxiety. When I say normalize, I don't mean you don't treat it, but you make clear to the person that's experiencing it, the caregiver, that it is not because of a weak psyche. It is more situational. Slide number 12, how do assessment Now, this isn't an assessment in the usual psychometric sense. It's more a qualitative assessment. And these are the questions that I ask the families that I work with in my private therapy practice over the years, but also after disasters in the field. How physically present is the family member in question? After 9/11, of course, they were not at all. They were disappeared. With caregiving for Alzheimer's disease, they may say, well, they're in the other room. I can see them. How psychologically present is he or she from your point of view? So I want the caregiver's point of view. And then also you can use the medical information about activities of daily living, how much can they do, and so on. So you'd want both the medical data there, but their own perceptual data as well. And they will tell you things like, I feel alone. He's here, but he's not here. I'm so lonely in this work. Or if he would only talk to me, I could do this work better. They'll give you clues about what is troubling them. Then the question is, might this change over time? With traumatic brain injury, this is confusing because we're now having such a barrage of soldiers coming back with TBI, and we don't quite know if some of it will be reparative or not. And so the answer to that question might be, we don't know yet. That's a little more ambiguity, but sometimes that's better than no answer at all. What can family members do to enhance cognitive and emotional presence? Or is there nothing they can do at this time? Mindfulness is sometimes helpful here, but sometimes you will know the situation perhaps better. If there is no chance of cognitive and emotional presence improving, like someone who is in a coma and not likely to wake up again, then you really need to focus on helping them to live with somebody who's partly here and partly gone. And you move in that direction. Not rapidly, slowly. All of this work is gradually. Slide 13, you describe the perceptions of the missing person's physical and psychological presence in your life. So I would ask the caregiver to do that. Another point, you use multiple methods, narratives that would be their stories, and which is qualitative data, but you also use the quantitative data from the doctor's reports, from their assessments, which activities of daily living and so on, which end up in scores. Regarding further assessment, I refer you to a special issue on ambiguous loss in the journal called Family Relations. It is coming out not in March. It is coming out in April. We're a month late. Sorry about that. So it will be April 2007. It should be in any academic library. Social work libraries tend to carry this journal. Or you can find out from the National Council on Family Relations how to obtain that particular issue of the journal. Slide number 14. Assessment questions now more specific. First, for family boundary ambiguity, how do you set boundaries in a family when somebody is only partly here and partly gone? You ask the caregiver, who is family now for you? Sometimes a woman whose husband has dementia will actually answer me, my neighbor lady who's my best friend. It could be any kind of answer. Frequently is not biological or a legal family. It may be the pastor. It may be you. Has it changed due to the ambiguous loss? Who's in and who's out of your family now? How do you see the missing person's place in your marriage or family now? Who is there for you now? They always need somebody to be there for them. Caregiving is hard work, so you want to know who that person is. Have some other professional team members become like family to you now? Sometimes they will say people like you are part of their family, or a nurse is part of their family now, or the nursing home aides. What other help or support do you need? on slide 15, there is also something called role ambiguity. And this is an easy one to assess. You ask the caregiver, what family roles or tasks have you lost as a result of this ambiguous loss situation? Wives of the service people coming back frequently say they've lost the role of spouse. Sexual intimacy may be gone, and these are young couples, and a young wife may say she feels more like a she's now a caregiver, but no longer playing the role of wife as she used to. What family roles or tasks have you gained? How do you manage these changes due to the ambiguous loss? You want to hear each person's story because you will not find a total consistency over time based on diversity and differences in religious beliefs and cultural backgrounds. That's why I ask these questions, so that the intervention can take into account these differences. Continuing role ambiguity on slide 16. What parental family rules have changed? Is gender an issue? Is generation an issue? For example, can a woman now take over the family finances because the husband is impaired? Or, regarding generation, can the adult child or the adult son or daughter now take over because the parents are impaired? Who does what? Chores, meals, housekeeping, caregiving, decision-making, money management. And I think one of our jobs is to spread out those tasks to other siblings, other people. One person just simply can't do all of that alone. And by the way, if family members are spread out across the United States, you can have them in on telephone conferences. And of course, if relatives and loved ones are in another country and unavailable, then we have to enlist the community or the faith-based place of worship or communities centers to get more people to help. One person just simply can't do all this alone. So is there a team approach, or does it fall to one person to hold everything together? It just can't. By the way, I need to tell you, that's a terrible statistic. Caregivers die at a rate 60% higher than their same age cohort. I'm going to repeat that. Caregivers die at a rate 60% higher than their age cohort. In sum, what I can say then is caregiving is dangerous to your health, and that's why we need to enlist a team rather than one person doing the caregiving. Slide 17, what family or community celebrations, rituals, events did you celebrate as a couple or family before the ambiguous loss occurred? They'll tell you that. And now, what do you do now? And don't be surprised if you hear a lot of them say they canceled them. And our job is to get them to reconstruct their family rituals and celebrations to fit the circumstances now. It's very important to have rituals and celebrations, celebrate birthdays, celebrate holidays, etc., in a family, because that is the guts of family life. And if we don't celebrate together, if we don't have rituals and celebrations together, then it's an empty family. And people need, whether it's a psychological family or a biological marital family, people need connectedness, human connectedness. And so this is an easy place to start, to talk about what would be the next ritual or celebrations you would ordinarily celebrate, and let's talk about how to reconstruct it. Okay. I want to tell you, after 9/11, I thought it would be Thanksgiving that they would want to talk about. But in fact, all these families, all of whom came from different islands off the coast of the United States, Mexico and South America, Central America, and so on. So I thought it would be Thanksgiving when I said, what's the next celebration your family would have? I was wrong. They said Halloween. And so their question was, would we dare celebrate Halloween, allow our children to celebrate Halloween while their dad or mom is still down in the World Trade Center pile missing? Can you dress your kids up in ghosts and goblins when your loved one is missing? Now, that was an interesting question, and what I would encourage you to do is not answer those questions, but to gather the families together in multiple family meetings so that they can answer the question with each other and have elders in that group as well, grandmas, grandpas, aunts and uncles, and the elder people in the group who have had more experience with trauma and stress over the years, help the younger mothers and fathers to answer that question. I think one of the things I've learned in the ambiguous loss work is to know that I don't know all the answers all the time, most of the time, I would say, but that it's our job to set the stage so that these people can come up with some answers to help them in their particular situation. And since ethnicity frequently differs, that is why we have to listen more and learn more as opposed to think we have the answer. You know, I come from a southern Wisconsin farm family, which was an immigrant family from Switzerland. That's pretty useless information in this kind of setting in lower Manhattan with a lot of immigrant families from 17 different religions and about 70 different cultures. I suspect you have the same kind of conditions out in California, the wonders of diversity, which I think is a good thing. That means we have to set the stage and listen and how to structure the interventions for in a more tailor-made way. On slide 18, the interventions, the structure, the focus, and goal. Individual and multiple family meetings in a community setting are highly recommended. And that would be, let's take dementia, for example. We have that here, and it's very highly accepted. Saturday morning groups come in. They're caregiving for someone with dementia. Sometimes they bring the person in with them, and sometimes they don't. The group is flexible. They can come either way they want. Sometimes adult kids come. Sometimes spouses come. And they get camaraderie. They get to see that they're not alone in their ambiguous loss. And they also get information. And by the way, I would always add some kind of food. Food is healing and nurturing. And people who are experiencing ambiguous loss need nurturing. It is a very functional tool when you have these group meetings. Number two, professional training and family therapy. Not everyone is trained to deal with more than one person in the room at the same time, and that is unfortunate. So I would seek some training like that if you don't already have it so that you can tolerate more than one person in the room at the same time so that you can have not just the caregiver but bring in the rest of the family team, the rest of the psychological family who might help him or her. And yes, it's more chaotic and you need more chairs in the room, or better yet, family therapy is often done in the home of that person, but then that requires a different skill as well, and then safety becomes also a skill you need to learn. Our preferred way of doing in-home family therapy is with two people going at a time. One could simply be a driver, that is a paraprofessional, and then one, the trained social worker, but it's better to have two than one for that. Open door policy versus termination. Let's talk about that for a minute. In therapy, and I believe in social work as well, which has somewhat of an analytic history to it, termination is the goal, is the end point of therapy. And you actually have used the term termination, at least in analysis they do. With ambiguous loss, termination is not a functional goal because you are still going to be on this earth and they can't get to you anymore, and so you are just an additional ambiguous loss to the people who already came to you to learn how to deal with an ambiguous loss. So we don't want to add to their distress. Therefore, I've come to the conclusion of using an open door policy. And the open door policy is that we would have an ending. That is, we've worked on what we wanted to work on, and that goal has now been met. So we would say something like that. But I would always add, but the door is always open should you have some other issues down the line. That seems to be very functional, and I have, after 30 years of work, not had anyone who abused that. Sometimes, by the way, they'll come back 5 years later, a year later, when something else happens in their family, and they work on it again a while, and then they leave, and I don't see them perhaps ever, or maybe not a couple years later on. So open door policy is a good idea. Cognitive and emotional interventions, what I listed there was to indicate to you that both are needed. In the field these days, we argue about which one is better, cognitive therapy, emotional-based therapy. What I'm saying is you're going to need both. Cognitive-based therapy is necessary to help people get online again regarding decision-making and making choices and so on. How to interpret what is happening to them. But emotional-based interventions are needed regarding how to grieve for somebody who's still alive without moving oneself into shame, how to deal with losses that are unclear, how to redefine attachment and identity. The focus will be on resiliency. That is, increasing one's tolerance for ambiguity and change and moving forward despite ambiguity and uncertainty. The guidelines, then, on slide number 19, for intervention are simply guidelines. So circle the word guidelines. It is not strategies. The guidelines are only there to guide you. But you will know the condition of ambiguous loss. You will know the diversity, the different religious beliefs, the different geographical, regional settings, etc., of the people you're working with. So you're going to need to fit these to your work. They are finding meaning, tempering mastery, reconstructing identity, normalizing ambivalence, revising attachment, and discovering hope. Now, do we have some questions before we go on to the last section?
We do have a question from the Coast Caregiver and line.
For Dr. Ross, on slide number 9, talked about number 5, prevents closure, and you said it was a problem word for yourself. It's always been a problem word for me, and in fact, I don't use it. And to me, it reminds me of what you mentioned about the American Indians, about fixing and letting it go. And I'm wondering, how can one in this field eliminate this word closure, because I hear it so often, and people that I work with, caregivers, will tell me, please don't say the word closure to me, because...
Yes, they hate it. In fact, they may not ask you to come back if we proceed along those lines.
Thank you.
You're absolutely right. You were asking what to use instead, was that it?
Or how can we eliminate that from the psychology community, the vocabulary, or...
And the journalists are using it, too. Have you noticed?
Yes.
Uh-huh. Well, I think we have to talk, speak up, and keep reminding our other people of that. but in our own work, which is what I would focus on first, and that is to stop ourselves from using it, because in fact we were trained to use it. And later on I'm going to say a little bit more about maybe how it is related to these assumptions of mastery that we have in our culture about fixing things and so on. When you're dealing with ambiguous loss, you cannot have closure because the situation will not be fixed. Living with someone in a coma for 10 years very rarely ends in somebody waking up and being normal again. Living with someone with traumatic brain injury, they may improve some, but they are rarely, if ever, again, the way they used to be. And just the experience of war makes people not the way they used to be. So we have to learn to live with change, not closure. And, of course, we don't like that. We like things the way we want them to be. And so closure is a word that makes us feel better because it says, if I do everything right, I can close this door, be done with this thing, and move on. Well, it doesn't work that way. Not even a clear-cut death does. Dorothy Beckfar has written a very good book on grieving death, and she calls it living with grief. And that's even with a clear-cut death, she is saying there's no closure. You have to learn to live with the grief. I agree with her. So if that's true for a clear-cut death, it is even much more true for ambiguous loss when there isn't that certainty of death, when somebody is just half here and half gone. So I think in our when the papers you write and the people you talk to and the work that you do, just talk with other people about this. Talk with your caregivers. I think they'll like that approach.
Thank you.
Thank you. Good question.
Thank you.
Are there other questions?
Yeah, we do have another question from the line of Del Oro caregiver. Please go ahead with the question.
Barb, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Hi. This is Barbara from Del Oro Caregiver Resource Center. Up in Nevada County in California. I also was going to comment a little bit, too, about the word closure. And I remember the Stephen Levine, one of the reasons why he broke away from Elizabeth Kubler-Ross had to do with the word acceptance, because he felt that we were trying to tie a pretty bow at the end of grieving by, okay, now we've accepted everything. And his book, Healing into Life and Death, is another really wonderful resource in working with people with ambiguous loss. And I don't know if you're familiar with Pema Chodron.
No.
Yes, When Things Fall Apart also is another really wonderful
book. Oh, thank you for that.
On groundlessness and living, you know, with trying to be in the present with the suffering that...
That's right. It's, you know, and we're talking about mindfulness these days. It really is being able to sit with the ambiguity. But clearly, the ancient Eastern people, have done a better job of that with yoga, with Tai Chi and so on than we have. We're not very good at sitting with something that can't be fixed. We're great problem solvers, and that's, of course, a good thing, but it's not a good thing when the problem has no solution. So those are two other, I wrote those down. Thank you for those.
Hi, this is Beth, and I have a question, Pauline.
Okay.
On slide 18, you talked about the individual and multiple family meetings in a community setting. And to me, it sounded like you were structuring these meetings to focus primarily on the ambiguous loss and the feelings of grief that the families are experiencing. How is that different from a support group?
It isn't entirely different, and it isn't just a focus on ambiguous loss. The underlying goal is to rebuild connection with other human beings. Because people suffering from ambiguity and loss frequently are so confused that they withdraw. And so our goal here, like after the disaster in Oklahoma or wherever, and with Alzheimer's caregivers, and now I hope with families of the returning veterans, is to bring them together to, first of all, find each other, know they're not alone, to have some movement. You know that movement is a major treatment for trauma now. So it just could be socializing, having a meal together, talking together, and then some information that may be of help. So a support group is somewhat like that, but there are a few differences. If you'd like to see the exact thing of, for example, what we did in New York, which you could translate to your setting for whatever ambiguous loss you're working with, it was in the Journal of Marriage and Family Therapy, and it is on my website, the reference, that you could get a hold of that article.
Great. Great. Thank you. Are there other questions?
Okay. Should we move on then?
We did have one more question if you
okay.
want to take it.
Yeah,
great.
We have time, Pauline.
Okay.
It's from the Del Mar caregiver.
Thank you. I wonder if you could define or just clarify for me tempering mastery.
Yes, that's coming up in the next session, but let me say that for you. I'm going to define each of those six in the next section.
Okay, thank you.
But briefly, the word mastery comes from Leonard Perlin's use of mastery, which essentially states, I feel as if I'm in charge of my own life.
Hmm.
And tempering it means that maybe I'm not all the time. And my point is that if you are caregiving for ambiguous loss and you are highly mastery oriented, which many Americans are, by the way, it's one of the social underpinnings, you know, that I suppose cleared the prairies and got us to California in the stagecoach days, and it got us to put a man on the moon, etc. So it has good things to it. But when you're dealing with a situation that has no cure or no solution, it distresses people immensely. And therefore, we need to temper, we need to modulate mastery.
Thank you.
But we'll talk a little more about that. I think it's the most important idea in the book, actually. Thank you for your questions. Okay. Should we carry
Daniel,
on then?
Do we have any other questions, Daniel? Looks not. Why don't we move on, Dr. Ball?
Okay. All right, the six guidelines. The six guidelines, we're on slide 20. The six guidelines are not a linear stage model. Kubler-Ross had a linear stage model of saying she ordered depression and anger and so on, acceptance. While some of those terms are relevant, indeed, people just aren't that neat about how they cope and grieve. And it's more circular. And people go back and forth, by the way, and repeat stages. So we need to give up the idea of linear stage model. So we have a circular model, and it's meant to be applied as a process model. By that I mean human beings interacting with each other for working over time with families of clients with chronic conditions that cause ambiguous loss. They're often called patients in my work because they're referred to me by physicians. The family is referred to me by a physician who takes care of the patient. And my job, as your job may be, is to take care of the family member who's taking care of the patient at home. Slide number 21, systemic perspective. I suspect you've heard of this because, in my experience, social workers know this better than psychologists do. And in my training at the university, the social workers would catch on to this right away because they understand the word social. rather than the more individual perspective. Systems perspective means that we're looking at the larger context surrounding the individual caregiver. All of the interventions are addressed to each family member. That is, I wouldn't just focus on one caregiver. I would ask the other family members that they define as family, by the way, to come in with them in some way, either tape record the session for them and then tape record their response, or have them in by telephone, or have them in body, which would just require you to have a few more chairs. Life cycle issues become important here. For example, if the caregiver is in his or her 70s or 80s, caregiving is going to be more damaging to their and more threat to their own life and health than it might be to a 40-year-old. But on the other hand, a 40-year-old may be caregiving for her mother, but she's also taking care of her own children, so she becomes part of that sandwich generation. So you need to look at the context of the stress that the caregiver is experiencing. And again, that will be different for each case, so you need to just ask about it. One of the things that I find difficult is for families that are accustomed to extended family situations for coping with stress who immigrate. And then the women have no sisters, no mother, no grandmother, no aunts to help her with taking care of the ill. And those situations are quite dangerous because they are not aware of how else to cope, where else to reach for help, because they're, the women in their family are cut off in another place away from them. Each person will have their own perceptions, so there is often conflict over the differences in how the families see the situation of ambiguous loss. Nevertheless, I do ask each person to tell me how they see it. And if arguments develop, and they will, then we just use our communication skills, strategies for how to manage conflict in a situation. I'm sure you've been trained in that, and you may even say, okay, now it's your turn to talk, and then it's your turn to talk. But the most important thing to say is that it's okay to see the situation differently. You may need to say that over and over again. It's okay for each of you to see the situation differently. One female caregiver, a grandmother, was tired. She wanted to go for Alzheimer's disease. Her husband had Alzheimer's disease. She wanted to go to visit her sister in Florida. And she said, and go dancing with my sister. And her adult sons just went crazy, thinking she was being disloyal to their father, who was bedridden with Alzheimer's disease. And she said, no, I just need 2 weeks to go and have fun with my sister in Florida. I saw the three-generational family, and it was the grandson who understood it more rapidly than anyone else. And he said, I understand. Grandma needs a rest. She needs to go to Florida. It isn't like she's leaving Grandpa. She just needs a rest. And so he was able to tell his father not to be so worried that Grandma was being disloyal and running away. In the end, that family decided to seek nursing home care for 2 weeks while she went to Florida, and then she came back. I would assume that she truly did, for her own, the sake of her own health, need that respite. That's why you need to have group meetings, of either a family group or a non-related group, but more people in the situation will actually make your job easier. Adding people to the room will actually make your job easier. Third, work with dyads and families and communities to accept these differences in perceptions of who is physically or psychologically missing. Not everybody agrees. And by the way, that's very interesting. And then you would be the one to mediate that discussion. The thing to remember is that there is no right answer. When people are missing, you can't say for sure if they're irretrievably gone or not. So you just leave it there, that it's ambiguous, and that our job will be to learn how to live with the stress of the ambiguity. Okay, slide 22, interventions. What helps and what hinders? Now here, there's a chapter on each one of these, so it isn't, we're just touching the tip of the iceberg here today by talking about a few. I can't possibly talk about everything I wrote about each one of these six guidelines. But let's start and see how much we can get. Finding meaning. Well, I think you have read perhaps some of the literature after World War II and the Holocaust. One of my favorite is Viktor Frankl's The Search for Meaning, upon which I have built, and then there has been much more since that, and then I also weave into it the ideas of Kenneth Gergen, who's now a professor at Swarthmore, who believes in social construction as a paradigm, but the base of it is meaning, the search for meaning. Now, if you are psychometricians or quantifiers and you like numbers, you might not like this approach because it's hard to put a number on meaning. And also, each family member may have a different meaning, or each mate in a couple may have a different meaning. And our job is to listen to each one and then to help them to move forward, not to judge their meanings, unless, of course, the meaning is harmful to them. Now, let's jump down to what hinders first. What hinders is a desire for revenge. Somebody makes your son or daughter have brain injury, and so you say, I will get that SOB. I'm going to take my revenge, and I'm going to harm their son or daughter because they harmed my son or daughter. If anybody in the caregiving family has that meaning, we take a more direct intervention to try and reconstruct their view. But most helpful in that is having more people in the room so that other people, especially elders, grandmas and grandpas, I keep repeating, are very helpful to help modify that revengeful meaning. Gaining retribution doesn't help. Many of the people in Oklahoma thought they would feel better after Timothy McVeigh was executed, so there was a bigger audience for that execution than almost any other execution that ever took place. But people don't feel better the next morning. People feel better through human connection and through starting to move again physically, literally physically, through yoga, through running, through singing, through dancing, through eating a meal together, etc. So it's human connection which helps more than anything else. Secrets are also a hindrance. So you would incur, if you sense that any secrets are being held in this family regarding the illness or regarding the person who is being cared for, try to convince them that secrets, and they're usually held from children, by the way, secrets are not helpful. You don't need to tell children all the facts, but you need to tell them something, and it needs to be truthful. Because if you do not, then you have the next generation being dysfunctional because of the ambiguous loss in this generation. And in fact, that did happen and is still happening in Germany. And as a result of the Holocaust and the Nazi atrocities. What helps? Naming the problem helps. one of the first things I do is saying, what you're suffering from is ambiguous loss. It's not your fault. The ambiguity is confusing and causes stress. That's about all I would say, but that is important, that they want a name for what they're feeling, and it has no name. And they seem quite often relieved that it has a name. I frequently share the 1999 paperback, the paperback came out in 2000 actually, called Ambiguous Loss, with people who like to read. That book can be read by the general population. And it's out in about 6-7 different languages. So it's Spanish, for example, is available. The second thing that helps is dialectical thinking. Let's talk about that. When you can't find meaning, a clear-cut meaning in a situation, that is, my loved one is here or my loved one is gone, the only way out is to think both and, which is what I call dialectical thinking, both and thinking. And what you say, and help the people to understand this, help your caregivers to understand that the person is here, but they're also gone. It's a both and. And that our job is to learn to live with two opposing ideas. They're here, but they're also gone. The Alzheimer's patient is here, but he's also gone. He's still my husband, but he's not really the way my husband used to be. You would be surprised how quickly ordinary people catch on to that. Of course, I do not use the word dialectical thinking with them. I use the term both and thinking, and they understand it immediately because they're experiencing it. And then seeing suffering as part of life. Some people who perhaps have had a pretty good life, which many of us have had, are troubled when we suffer and say, we didn't deserve this. Why me? And the question that of course, is the core of many religious questions. But in the book, I've written about different views on why me? Why am I suffering? And I find the more Eastern views interesting to me because I come from a highly mastery-oriented background. I find the Eastern views helpful because they say that thinking you should never have to suffer is ego wanting its own way. Thinking you should never have to suffer is your ego wanting it to have its own way. I was amused by that, and I would say, yep, I guess that is it. Never thought to look at it that way. So the more Eastern, the more a Buddhist view is that suffering is part of life for everyone, sooner or later, and that what you do is learn to live with the suffering rather than always thinking you don't deserve it or thinking you must eradicate it. As I said earlier, I would hope that illnesses would be cures found for illnesses and so on, but there are some that have no cure. And, of course, in the end, death comes to everyone. And we need to have a different view of the meaning of this rather than seeing it as failure, which is what we do now. And that leads us very nicely into slide 23, which is the next chapter, chapter 5 then, was Tempering Mastery.
Dr. Boss, we have 15 minutes left.
Okay, thank you. I'll hurry a bit more. Again, this came from Leonard Perlin's A Sense of Control Over One's Life. And believing in mastery means things like I can do just about anything I set my mind to. I can solve any problem. I can have control over what happens to me. And many of us will score pretty highly on a mastery scale. And so we have to work pretty hard when it comes to having a situation that has no cure. What helps is recognizing where views of mastery come from, and they're cultural, and I've written a great deal about that. You might find that interesting. And externalizing the blame. If you believe too highly in mastery, you will have to find somebody to blame, and that'll either blaming yourself for not having done a good job or blaming someone else in the family, which just makes conflict. So what we want to do here is externalize the blame. The culprit in what we're talking about today is the ambiguity. The culprit is the ambiguity. What hinders too much mastery, too little mastery, blaming oneself for not being able to fix the problem. The third is reconstructing identity. What helps? Redefining who the family is, who plays what roles, being flexible about gender and generation. When someone in the family is suddenly there but not there, let's say dementia or traumatic brain injury, you may have to redefine who the family is. And people, women will say things to me like, am I a wife or not anymore? What is my role now? And your role may be to take care of this other person as the primary caregiver. But one of the roles you want to point out to her is your role is also to take care of yourself. Remember that statistic I gave you about the dangers of caregiving. And that role she may not take to as well. Frequently male caregivers are more willing to take care of themselves as well as caregiving, and women more likely to devote 100% of their time to caregiving and then neglecting themselves. What hinders? Discrimination and stigma. When you have ambiguous losses, new identities are given to people, like ex-spouse, single parent, co-parent. Those are after divorces. Or things like ex-priest, or things like immigrant. Regarding a traumatic brain injury, I'm told that the soldiers prefer to be called soldier than veteran, when in fact they probably will technically be veterans. Widow is a new identity. Sexual orientation, once people come out, may have a new identity. And what you want is no discrimination and no stigma. And, of course, that is a societal issue. But as professionals, we need to be clear about our own views and that we do not discriminate and stigmatize also. Help people not to hang on to an absolute identity. Let's face it, all of our identities will change as we get older. And so we need to embrace the change in identity and not say, I'm going to hang on to the way things were. That was the best way. So rigidity doesn't help. Number four, normalizing ambivalence. Ambivalence is anxiety from conflicted emotions and behaviors. What helps? Being aware of one's ambivalence, normalizing negative feelings and guilt, but not harmful actions. So you may feel like killing somebody, but you dare not do it. Or you may feel anger at a patient you're caring for, but you need to express that anger and identify it, but not act it out. What hinders ambivalence, expecting typical coping strategies? They are not typical. And so there I would, that's a difficult topic, this ambivalence. In my training, I find that people have the most trouble with that one, so I would refer you to that chapter, except that I would say this. Ambiguity causes ambivalence. So in this case, this is not psychiatric ambivalence. This is sociological ambivalence from the social situation. The culprit is the ambiguity, not the person's psyche. Number five is revising attachment. When someone is partly lost, you need to revise your attachment to them, and it's harder to do than if there was a clear-cut death. because they're still here or they may return. What helps, again, thinking dialectically, both and, moving from despair to protest, you need to have some action to change something, change a law if there's a missing child. Protest as the families of the VA are doing now. Protest as the VA staff are talking more about how to help themselves not to become demoralized, and so on, and build new human connections. What hinders overemphasis on individualism and self-sufficiency, and again, expecting closure on a lost relationship. If you bring up closure, people will resist you because they still want to be attached to someone even, and so you need the both-and approach, which says stay attached to this person, but at the same time, why don't you go golfing? Why don't you go out to dinner with some friends? Why don't you develop some new connections? So it's a both-and. Finally, discovering hope, what helps? Increasing one's tolerance for ambiguity through redefining justice, imagining options, even laughing at absurdity sometimes. All of this can, by the way, be viewed as some forms of spirituality. So a kind of spiritual view of ambiguity helps. And whether that's a formal religious view or a more a nature-oriented view or artistic-oriented view of spirituality, doesn't matter as long as they can be tolerant of ambiguity, imagine options, and so on. What hinders is an insistence on closure and termination and an endpoint to the stress and ambiguity of loss. The conclusion on slide 28 is ambiguous loss is a traumatic loss, but it's ongoing and thus can't have closure. It is an irresolvable loss and thus produces symptoms similar to complicated grief. Depression and anxiety are main ones. Ambiguous loss is a relational condition and thus requires relational interventions. The framework can be used by various professionals for various illnesses and conditions. That's important for you because you all do different kinds of work. It is thus a more inclusive lens, and I believe it is applicable across cultures and diversities. Slide 29, the ambiguous loss lens is stress-based, not medically based, and thus more readily accepted by individuals and families who, through no fault of their own, are often immobilized by loved ones who are missing, partly absent, or partly present. Okay, I don't know if we have any time for questions.
Oh, yes, we sure do.
Okay.
There are no questions at this time. And now we do have a question. It's from Coast Caregiver. Go to the question.
Is somebody picking that up?
We'll just move on to the next question. It comes from the line of Delaro Caregiver, Barbara Ellard. Go ahead.
Yes, I'm calling from the Grass Valley Satellite Office. My name is Sarah.
Hi there.
Hi. I've had, going back to support groups.
Can you speak up just a little louder?
Oh, I've had a couple of caregivers, well, more than two, complain of not wanting to go to support groups because they don't, they have a hard time coping with all the grief that's expressed. They said, I'm feeling sad enough. I don't want to go to a support group.
Yeah. That's what someone mentioned earlier, the difference between support groups and meetings. I think you should incorporate some more fun into your support groups. And if you have to change the name of it, meeting is a good word.
Okay.
It's so neutral. But you might not have to do that. But I would, what we learn in the trauma field is that listening to stories of pain can re-traumatize other people.
Yes.
So what you want to do is, the research is really clear now, move more toward yoga. I can't, when the people suggested having massage therapists come in, I thought they were nuts. Well, they're not. Having chair massage people come in, having food. I mentioned that before.
Right.
We sometimes had music. These were many people from Mexico. They loved to dance with their children. But I don't know what your group likes to do. Maybe play cards. I don't know what they like to do. But make it more fun. Now, you may say you don't feel like you're doing your job. Well, I'll tell you, the research is clear now. It's new, and it's based on brain imaging, so it's hard to argue with.
Mm-hmm.
And that is telling one story over and over again is harmful.
Uh-huh.
And so what you want to do is let them tell it once, and then somebody, you and maybe other people, should be fully present while they tell their story to witness it. But then don't go around and around in retelling stories. So you want to move from the telling the story, telling your pain story, you want to move to a more movement orientation where the body is moving. So, and or yoga or dancing or eating together, whatever. Maybe if you walk around the block, if there's someone else in the house to take care of the person, movement. I can't tell you how surprising this finding is, but all of these things are more effective than talk therapy.
I agree heartily, and this is the way I have felt for years. I am not a facilitator. These are various support groups in different counties that I refer caregivers
mm-hmm.
to. So see if you agree with that, if I could encourage the caregiver to initiate these ideas in the group.
Yes. And also the group will, once you give them permission, once they know that you're going to change course, they have ideas.
Mm-hmm.
So when I say these shouldn't be extra burden on the social worker, people should be bringing these things in. And if they want to play a certain CD, they should bring it. Or if they want to do a certain thing, they should be the leader of it then.
Mm-hmm.
The massage therapy, though, is very helpful. I'm just shocked by that. They convinced me. I mean, the brain imaging, you just can't argue with it, and I was just stunned by it. The military is now, in some places, instigating yoga for returning veterans.
Mm-hmm.
Yoga is the strongest healer of trauma. Mm-hmm. Well, these ancient civilizations of India and China apparently learned something over the decades and eons.
Absolutely.
And now we're beginning to borrow these Eastern ideas for, you can't just take a pill for these things.
Right, right.
So good. So just be more imaginative, more creative.
Okay.
And sometimes having younger people and older people, I love having three generations in these groups because what one doesn't think of,
the other does. Thank you so much, Dr. Buzz.
You're welcome.
By the way, my family's from St. Cloud, Minnesota originally.
Oh, my. Wonderful. Wonderful. You migrated west.
Uh-huh. Enjoy my roots. Thank you.
Uh-huh.
Do we have another question, Daniel?
No, not at this time.
We do have time for our final question.
Okay, we do have one final question.
Great.
And
where?
Go ahead.
Oh, okay. I've been pushing the one. You know, when we do, this is Dave Fraser at Inland Caregiver Resource Center. We do, home visits with our families.
Mm-hmm.
And we, are tasked with a huge number of issues, you know, trying to arrange respite care, trying to link the family to other resources, dealing with depressive symptoms. And I'm just wondering, if you would offer some ideas or guidelines as to, what do we tackle first? another way to look at it, are there some particular warning signs that would suggest that this would be a good candidate, this family would be a good candidate, this caregiver would be a good candidate to move into, focusing more on the ambiguous loss situation? I know it's a huge...
Well, they all are, I think, for that, because it relieves, you'll see it relieves them.
Yeah.
They they think they are trying to do a good job, and then they feel depressed, and then they feel think they failed.
Yeah.
So it would take the burden off of them for saying, I'm weak, I got sick, and I shouldn't have. So I would use that approach on all of them to know that the culprit is the ambiguity. And if they are depressed or anxious, it's not their fault that any of us would be under those conditions. But then I would, and yes, you have to deal with the symptoms, but I don't quite know how you work, so I may be off track here, but this, you must enlist the other people. The one, it's too much for one caregiver. I hate the term primary caregiver, even though I know it exists. We need to find out who the other people are who will help this caregiver. And so I call a family meeting, and I tell her, if it's a female caregiver, I want you to bring everybody you consider family to this meeting. And if they can't come, then you tape record or you write letters or you do something else, phone call. And the burden of that work should be on a family member. So you'd ask her who in this family can help you, because there might be a teenager who could do a listserv on the computer and tell all the family at once. So I'm not meaning to increase your work. I'm meaning to decrease your work, make you more effective without more burden. If you enlist more people in the family, then they can help this caregiver get respite. That shouldn't be your job, but it shouldn't be the caregiver's job either, because she's already or he's already overburdened. So you need other people. And the other people, ideally, are the psychological family or the biological family. If there is nobody, I would go to the church if there is, if they belong to a church. And if not that, some community organization. You need more help. If only you and the caregiver are the system, it's too small. There's too much burden. There's too much work to be done for two people. Okay?
Great, thanks. We've been pushing the one, so we're going to ask another question, if you don't mind.
Okay.
Additional question. I'm Lydia Waller. I'm also with Inland Caregiver, I guess.
Hi.
And, hi. I had a question on the intervention structure and focus goal slide. You talk about the focus being resiliency, to increase one's tolerance for ambiguity.
Yes.
In caregivers and in people that are experiencing this kind of loss. When is that specific intervention not an appropriate intervention?
Yes. Resiliency can have a downside. Is that what you're talking about?
Right.
Yeah. Resiliency can have a downside, and the history of resiliency came out of poor children in the streets. And so clearly there, they were studying which children in poverty would be the most resilient. And the overall question, which never got asked, was how about getting rid of poverty? So you wouldn't need children to be quite this resilient. So given that history, now let's move it to the caregiving situation. You can't just ask a caregiver to solve the entire solution of all the work by being resilient. Eventually, the caregiver needs more help. So this ties into my previous answer. The system has to be made larger. It cannot just be you and the caregiver. There need to be more people. Like the Native Americans use all the siblings help with the caregiving. And the primary caregivers are the eldest boy and the eldest girl. So you have a team approach from the start. Resiliency, you can't just push and push and expect people to be resilient. Eventually, they have to revolt. But what caregivers do rather than revolt is they sacrifice their own health and die or get sick themselves. Mm-hmm. Excellent question. I'm glad you brought that up.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It is time to close our presentation, and Dr. Boss, I truly want to thank you very much on behalf of the Caregiver Resource Centers, and I'm thinking that what you have taught us is kind of a both and an and experience, where I think we were have all been validated for the work that we are doing and the way we are working with our family caregivers. And we've, through your teaching, has helped us go to kind of maybe a deeper level of the experience of the caregivers and the needs of the caregivers. And I think in essence just has helped us to be a little bit more compassionate. And it's obvious that we do have to, in our next training, learn about body massages.
Yes.
So
and the chair massages are quite ethical to use in these kinds of settings. And don't forget about singing and whatever else they want to do.
Singing and meditating and yoga and and mindfulness.
Mm-hmm.
So we do very much appreciate your presentation, and I wanted to tell the staff also that we will be sending you an email evaluation right after this program, and that's continuing education units are available, so please complete the sections that you need to complete, and that we will have the audio stream of the presentation up on the CRC website probably on Friday. So thank you all for joining us, and thank you again, Dr. Boss.
Thank you all. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.